our listeners to this broadcast is shooting from the hip on this beautiful Memorial Day weekend, the send-off to the weekend. I also want to remind our listeners that we're going to be on the air not only today, but on Monday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. And Shooting from the Hip is brought to you by SimTrainer, the Dayton area's first indoor range and firearms training center, and we're located at 2031 Dryden Road across from DP&L. You can visit us on the web at sim-trainer.com, or you can give us a call at 937-293-3914, and we'll be glad to help you with your firearm selection, firearms training needs, recreational shooting opportunities, competitive shooting, whatever it is you want to do involving the shooting sports. We can get you started, and if you're already started, we can give you a nice comfortable place to enjoy the shooting sports. I also want to remind our listeners, if you'd like to get on the air today, you can give us a call at 457-1290. That's 457-1290, and we'll be glad to get you up on the air. Just give us a call, and we'll do that. This was a particularly noteworthy week, and there's a few things I just wanted to bring to the listeners' attention that I thought was worthy of discussion, or at least letting people know. First of all, many of you probably saw on many of the gun blogs or the Buckeye Firearms Association that the Cuyahoga County judge in Cleveland had ordered the city of Cleveland to stop enforcing local gun control laws, which were essentially usurped by laws that have been passed in the last couple of years, and yet Cleveland had apparently been trying to impose its will. The city of Cleveland apparently had been trying to impose its will on the citizenry, and Cuyahoga County Common Pleas Judge Brian Corrigan ordered Cleveland to stop enforcement of 19 separate local gun control ordinances effective immediately. And I know that Mark has been talking about that for several months now, and I'm sure he has a few things to say about it.
Well, there was the Buckeye Firearms Association, or rather the Buckeye Firearms Foundation, filed a lawsuit back in early of 2009 because the city of Cleveland and Cuyahoga County had been enforcing laws that had been made null and void by the Castle Doctrine Bill and the preemption bill that were passed in the Ohio legislature that had already been tested in court. In fact, they had been told twice prior to quit doing this and ignored those instructions because they wanted to hold on to the position that home rule allowed them to do whatever they wanted to do and that the state could not regulate in those areas. And now this is the third time that the Supreme Court, or that a court, has told the city of Cleveland that they need to stop doing this. And now the next part is going to be, all right, let's see if we can get some financial penalty associated with that as more of a discouragement to keep them from doing actions which are illegal for them to do. And there's been no consequences for their actions. So this, let's see what happens next. Keep an eye on this.
It's good things to follow. Also, you saw in the Dayton Daily News that Dayton saw a significant drop of violent crime over the last couple of years. The Brookings Institute, the Metropolitan Policy Program wing of the Brookings Institution, which is a research entity, conducted a study, and they actually looked at violent crime rates over the last 20 to 25 years, and they found that Dayton actually saw a pretty substantial drop in crime. And last year we had Chief Beal from Dayton who came on the show, and he basically reaffirmed that. This is not new news. Violent crime is dropping around the country. Coinciding with that news, the NRA just recently released a newsletter or a document that stated that the FBI Uniform Crime Reports showed preliminary studies for 2010 showed a 5-6% decrease in violent crime. And what was significant about that was that during that same period, there's been a marked increase in gun ownership across the country. Now, as Mark and I just talked about before the show, that's certainly the increased gun ownership certainly didn't cause, we can't show that that was a direct cause of the decrease in crime, but we certainly know that the increased gun ownership did not result in an increase of crime, which some of the people who are trying to make allegations that people with guns commit more crime, it's simply not the case. And yet again, that is proven with preliminary data released by the FBI, which, by the way, is probably the most accurate data relative to violent crime available to us because law enforcement agencies are required by law to report violent crime on a regular basis to the FBI Uniform Crime Reports.
One of the things we like to do here at Shooting from the Hip is to give people the information to let them make their own decisions. So we have had for some time now links on our website at sim-trainer.com/radio that allows people to go out and actually look at the FBI uniform crime reports themselves. The most recent link on our website right now is from December 18th of 2010. So if you go out to our radio show webpage and scroll down to December 18th, there's a link there to the FBI uniform crime reports. Click on that link and it will open the FBI website and take you directly to the uniform crime report, which sometimes, I'll admit, is a little tough to find if you don't know exactly where you're going. So that shortcut will take you right there, and you can take a look at the preliminary statistics from calendar year 2010.
Another thing I just want to let you know about is in that article in the Dayton Daily News, they mentioned that violent crime is now spreading to the suburbs. And that is true with urban sprawl. Crime is going to the suburbs. But here's another thing I just want to let you know. When you look at that uniform crime reporting data and you look at the crime data, particularly on the city of Dayton, the entities that report, the larger municipal entities in the suburban areas, Englewood, Trotwood, Huber Heights, Kettering, Centerville, they're going to all have separate reporting mechanisms in place to put that data into the FBI Uniform Crime Report. So when you look at that, and here's what's interesting about that, and whether it's unfortunate or just factual, I don't know how you can make your own judgment. In the city of Kettering, for example, we may have seen an increase in homicide from 1 to 2 from 2009 to 2010. And I don't know the actual data. I know we haven't had many. And whereas in the city of Dayton, they may have seen, and I don't have the actual numbers because they didn't quote them, they may have seen a decrease in violent crime from 45 to 38. And I want you to just look at the numbers, but look more importantly at the rate, because obviously if there's a increase in Kettering or one of the suburban communities in homicides from 1 to 2 or 1 to 3, that's going to show a 100% increase, which makes it sound like it's a terrible situation. That's simply not the case. Violent crime is, in fact, increasing, but I can just tell you, working in a suburban community, we're getting a handle on that, and there's a lot of factors that go into that. The housing situation in the inner city is such that many of the people are moving to the suburban communities because there's better housing available, more readily affordable housing in some cases available because of the apartment complexes that have they've torn down several apartment complexes in the city of Dayton that housed a whole lot of people, and those people had to move to other areas. So there's a substantial number of factors that go into that. Mark, you wanted to make mention of something.
Yeah, I just have the data up. I mean, I was able to pull it up on the website from the link on our page at sim-trainer.com/radio. So the number of murders in Dayton in 2009, 40. The preliminary data shows 34 for Dayton in 2010. So that's a drop, and that's six people that are still with us that wouldn't have been in the year before. And that's 1,542 is the total number of violent crimes for 2009 and 1,509. So that's a fairly decent drop. We're talking not quite 10%.
Now, do they show any of the suburban? Can you pull up any of the data on Centerville or Kettering?
This particular summary has the Dayton level. Yeah, the major cities. It's got Akron, Cincinnati, Cleveland, Dayton, and Toledo.
Yeah. Well, how do we rate relative to the other major cities? Can you make any comparison? Do they show consistent?
Yeah, I'm going to have to do a little bit more analysis to be able to figure that out. But there are reductions across the board in each of these. In the violent crime, Toledo, for example, went from 3251 to 2854. Okay. Cleveland, another place, a 5994, almost 6,000 to 5,500, 5,520. Cincinnati dropped from a little bit smaller drop from 3983 to 3601, and Akron is a 1900 to 1600. So
yeah,
those are the kinds of statistics we're seeing across the board drops in violent crime, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, there are two things that I know people recently have attributed to. Just they throw out, the anti-gun people like to throw out the fact that, first of all, that more guns is going to result in more crime. That's been disproven. There's time and time again we've proven that to be wrong. They talk recently about, you know, the economy turning the way it is, with people, the jobless rate being the way it is. Well, we've been now a couple years in this recession, whatever you want to call it, and yet crime rates continue to go down. I just saw the other day one of the NFL football players said that if they don't settle the NFL strike, That there's going to be a resulting increase in violent crime because people on Sunday afternoons aren't going to have any way to vent their frustrations watching NFL football, so then violent crime is going to go up. So there's lots of theories going on out there about what causes it. Bottom line is individual accountability, and that in addition to increased enforcement efforts. The system, the criminal justice system, is attentive to the problems that are occurring, the overcrowded issues, the early release of people who commit additional crime. And even though those aren't, I'm not going to go so far as to say that those are being solved, people are paying attention to a variety of issues that are contributing to the crime problem. And particularly I'm interested in this whole concept of increased gun ownership and violent crime going down. I'm of the opinion, this is my personal opinion, just based on talking to people who come through our facility, that one of the factors, direct or indirect, or directly or indirectly, is that people are taking their personal safety more seriously. They're more attentive to their surroundings. They're paying more particular attention to the people that come around them. They're taking more effective measures to harden their targets, their residences, make it more difficult for people to commit crime. They're locking their doors. They're locking their cars. They're not leaving valuables out in the open. Now, that's not to say everybody, because all you have to do is pick up a daily newspaper and you'll see, you know, crime run rampant. Just the other night in Kettering, we had an individual hit five separate businesses. They broke into five separate businesses in, I think, less than 20 or 25 minutes. Now, I'm glad to report that we have very good information. We've got one subject in custody, and we know who the second subject is at the present time. So law enforcement has been effective in following up on that particular slew of crimes. But crime continues to occur, so I don't want in any way, shape, or form indicate that it's going away, but there's lots of things that are going to mediate against it.
Well, and that is absolutely true. It hasn't gone away, and unfortunately, there are a few very critical categories where the numbers went up over the last year. So forcible rape, for example, went from 91 to 92. Ladies, if you think that you're not at risk and that you don't need a gun or some other means to defend yourself, you're missing the information, because that is one of the areas that went up in Dayton from 91 to 92. Robbery went, and again, that's not, we're not talking about burglary. We're talking about somebody of a forcible taking of something from you as an individual. That's what robbery is. Went from 769 to 782. That's the wrong way. And those are attacks on the individual, and it's the individual who's the only one who's going to be able to be there to stop that. You and the criminal are the only two people that you can guarantee will be part of that situation, and you need to be able to defend yourself. We've said it many times. When seconds count, the police are only minutes away. You cannot depend on them to protect you. It's not their job. They know they can't do it. They want to be there. They simply, it's not possible. It is physically and just logistically completely impossible for them to do that. And quite frankly, as the Supreme Court has ruled, it is not their job. It is not their duty to provide you, the individual, with protection. That is something that you need to do for yourself. We need to take our first break for the hour, so if you'd like to be on the show with us, give us a call at 457-1290. 457-1290 will get you into our master control room with Justin Phelan, who will take your call and get you up on the board. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro for Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Hi, this is Cam Edwards from NRANews.com, and you're listening to Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM, News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro for Shooting from the Hip. Let's go directly out to the phones and talk to Mike in Centerville, who has a question for us. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mark and Jeff. Good to hear you guys. I took my concealed carry and the handgun series at your sim trainer, and you guys... I have a 13-year-old daughter that I am trying to convince to take the first shots class, and I was just hoping you'd kind of talk a little bit about it and why someone like her is a good person to take that.
Well, that's an excellent question. Thanks very much for taking your classes with us, and especially let me talk to your daughter for just a second. This
let me put her on.
Oh, okay. Well, she can listen on the radio as well. But hi, what's your name?
Kelsey.
Well, Kelsey, thanks very much for being part of our show today. Let me tell you, the First Shots program is a great way to get started into the shooting sports. It's very low threat. We use guns that are specifically designed for people who have never shot before, so they're real easy to use, and they're very easy. You don't have a whole lot of recoil, so it's not something that you have to be too intimidated about. Our First Shots program starts at 10 years old, so you're well past that, and you would be more than welcome to come join us. Have you even the slightest amount of interest in what's going on with guns? Have you seen Dad's guns and so forth?
Well, sometimes my dad took me shooting, but other than that, no.
Okay. Well, this is a great way to get started and to kind of work through some of that stuff about, you know, how do you do this properly? How can I be sure that the gun's not going to hurt me? How do I be safe with it? How do I make sure I'm not going to hurt someone else? How do I place that accurate shot? You know, one of the objectives that we have is to try to get the accurate shot so that you can put the gun, the hole in the target, exactly where you want it to be. And we go through quite a bit of detail on and show people how to do that. And that's one of the fun things that we do in that class.
The other thing that's a major advantage is we think it's a little bit more advantageous to have you learn in a more structured environment with somebody other than your father or your brother or your sister. It's just kind of the nature of how learning and teaching takes place. We tend to listen a little bit more attentively to a stranger, especially a stranger who's an expert in the area. So we really feel that would be a great opportunity for you to come down, get exposed to our facility. Obviously, you may have been there already, but you can see it in a little bit different light. It's non-intimidating. It's going to be a whole lot of fun. I mean, I just really take great pride in the fact that people who come out of the range after that 50 rounds of practice shooting, they're smiling from ear to ear, and I'm sure you would be in the same boat, and it'd be a great opportunity for you to get that kind of excitement energized in your first structured shooting training class.
So what do you think? You're going to come join us?
I'll think about it. I don't know.
Well, what is your concern?
Huh?
What would keep you from wanting to come?
Well, I don't like hurting things.
Oh, well, we're not going to hurt paper. No, seriously, that's what we're talking about. You know, this is the shooting is a lot more than just what you see on TV and the Hollywood view of it. And it's not all about personal defense, although a lot of people that start with First Shots eventually get to that point. But that's by no means what this is all about. The initial part of First Shots is strictly about the fundamentals of how do you handle a firearm safely and how do you shoot it accurately so that you can put a hole where you want it on that piece of paper down at the other end of at the end of the range.
And the other thing that I'll tell you is that you come out with your dad. Obviously, he can just drop you off or he can sit there and watch. But I'll make sure you get a T-shirt when you leave the class.
Thanks for calling the show. We need to take a break at the bottom of the hour and go over to the news center. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro for Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM, News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Hi, this is Rachel Parsons, spokesperson for the National Rifle Association, and you're on Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM, News Talk Radio, WHIO.
I want to welcome our listeners back to the show. And before we go out to the phones, I want to just remind our listeners to take a moment during your, either before, during, or after your festivities over the next several days that you might celebrate with friends, family, or neighbors to just reflect on the true purpose of Memorial Day, paying respect to the ultimate sacrifice that our veterans had made, our soldiers have made in obtaining and keeping our freedoms that we share and we love so much and are so close to our hearts.
And continue to make,
absolutely. And I just give you a couple of opportunities. This morning on the History Channel, I happened to watch a very powerful documentary about the sacrifices that our early colonists made in trying to revolt against the English government back in Revolutionary War days. And I want to encourage you, if you have cable television, two easy ways to kind of pay tribute and really gain a little bit of insight into what sacrifices were truly made when our soldiers were shipped away to foreign lands is if you watch an episode of Band of Brothers or of The Pacific. And I know a lot of that's made for TV drama, but in Band of Brothers, it's based on real accounts of actual situations that heard that are a little bit dramatized by the television. But the one segment on the Battle of the Bulge and the sacrifices that our soldiers made out in that cold, wintry land for months on end with limited provisions, I think it would really help you reflect and and be thankful for what they did and not let their deaths be in vain and to more or less give them the tribute that they're due. So again, I know that we sometimes get wrapped up in the festivities of the weekend and we lose sight of what Memorial Day is all about, but take a few moments to reflect on that and be thankful.
And Jeff and I will be back on Memorial Day morning at 8 o'clock for another episode of Shooting from the Hip, and we will hit some of this a little bit more at that time. 8 o'clock on Monday morning, Monday the 30th, for Shooting from the Hip. Let's go out to the phones now and talk to John in Dayton, who has a question for us. John, welcome to the show. Let me see what's going on here. All right, try that again. John, are you there with us?
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
I can. Thanks very much for joining the show.
Yeah, going through life, I've heard things such as if you're going to shoot somebody, if they come in your house because you feel threatened by them, that make sure you don't shoot them in the back, or same kind of thing outside and stuff. And so I'm just getting more curious about that. I'm a gun owner, but I'm not licensed to carry. And so my question is what's true and what's not true? Whether I got to make sure I shoot them indoors or on my property what's the facts there?
And those are great questions, and they come up all the time. Don't feel bad about that.
Let's start off with one premise. When deadly force is justified, the means at which you apply it and the location at which it's administered are pretty much irrelevant. And let me just clarify that a little bit. If you're in your home and an individual, let's set up the scenario. You're in bed at 1 o'clock in the morning. All of a sudden, you hear a loud smash. And it's reasonable for you to believe that somebody's attempting to get in your house. You go ahead and you obtain your firearm from wherever you safely store it in your house. You start looking around, and you're confronted in the middle of your living room with a black shadow. All you see is a dark shadow of somebody that you feel has put you and or your family member in imminent jeopardy, meaning that if you don't do something right away, either you or a family member could be seriously injured or killed, and you shoot the person. And let's say while you're shooting them, you fire the first shot, they turn and they start to run towards a door, and your second shot happens to hit them in the back. The issue isn't that you hit them in the back. It's whether or not you were justified in using deadly force in the situation as you, and only you, are going to describe it when the police get there on the scene. So it's based on the circumstances as you believe them at the time you used deadly force. And in that particular case, let me just ask you, in the scenario I gave you, why did you get your gun, number one? Short answer.
For protection due to the government-controlled decline of the economy.
Okay, and what was it reasonable for you to believe when you heard that loud smash?
Oh, that somebody's breaking into my house.
Okay.
I'm in danger.
And what might they do if you don't take reasonable measures to stop them from doing it?
Oh, they'll get a hold of my gun and use it on me.
or if they don't get your gun, what might they do?
Kill me. Steal my stuff, whatever.
Well, not steal you. I'm not so interested in steal your stuff because... The good thing is about the Castle Doctrine, they don't really, anymore, you're not going to be required to so much get into the mind of the criminal as to why he was there. All we're going to look at is what you reasonably believed at the instant you used deadly force.
Well, then my life is in danger.
There you go. There you go. And that pretty much kind of sums it up. And I think what happens a lot of times when people analyze this, they overanalyze it. And I want you to understand that deadly force is justified when you believe your life or someone else's life is an imminent danger. An imminent danger, basically in layman's terms, is described as circumstances which would lead a reasonable person to believe if they don't act immediately and use deadly force that either they or someone else is going to be seriously injured or killed. Okay? And in the scenario I gave you, in addition to the Castle Doctrine, which I think is a bonus in the scenario I just described, you reasonably feared for your life or the life of other people that were in your house at the time. Okay. Now, the other issue.
And the same goes for in my yard?
Well, the same circumstance would be in your yard, in a parking lot, in a grocery store, anywhere else where you believe, let's say a robbery goes down, and the robber decides he's not happy with the amount of money he gets from the grocer. Instead, he starts going around to each of the individual patrons, and he pistol whips the patron right before he comes to you to unconsciousness. Now, you have to make a decision. Are you going to go ahead and give the money and take the chance he's not going to be satisfied with the $17 you give him and he pistol whips you almost to the brink of unconsciousness? Or are you going to decide to take a stance, draw your gun, and use deadly force to stop what you believe is a crime that could result in imminent jeopardy, serious injury or death to you or other people?
Right.
See, so it really doesn't matter where you're at when those circumstances exist. And the nice thing about it, I'm just going to say not so much the nice thing, but here's the reality. It's going to be based on your interpretation of the facts when you were faced with the situation, not when I sit back on the radio show on Saturday morning and Monday morning quarterback, when the defense attorney or the plaintiff's attorney in the bad guy's family's estate, when they're trying to sue you for wrongful death, it's not going to be based on after-the-fact second-guessing of your decision-making as far as the criminal aspect of it goes. If you believe your life or someone else's life is in imminent jeopardy, you're justified in using deadly force to prevent that from happening. Oh, and it doesn't matter where you're at. And here's another thing. Let's say, just as in Arizona, even though one of the subjects that overpowered the gunman in the Arizona incident was armed, he chose, for a variety of reasons, not to, but they used physical force to overcome the resistance. And one of the guys actually smashed the guy over the head with a folding chair. Now, had that folding chair split the guy's head open and he died of head injury, the deadly force he used was reasonable for the circumstances. So the means at which he used the deadly force really is irrelevant as long as the deadly force was justified based on the bad guy's actions. That's another good example, I think, of where, now, in that particular case, the subject was just temporarily disoriented, and then they were able to physically subdue him until law enforcement arrived on the scene. But had they seriously injured or killed him, the deadly force they used by smacking him over the head with the chair was justified for the circumstances. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I can't possibly go over every possible scenario, but I just want to give you kind of a broad contextual overview and let you focus on, if I believe my life or someone else's life is in grave danger, I can use deadly force. And the means at which I do it doesn't matter.
Let me add one other thing to it, and that is that the portrayal that you're going to get from Hollywood through many, many of the law shows, the investigation, Law and Order, and so forth, they don't do a good job of representing reality as to what is the right of the individual and what is appropriate means and use of deadly force. For the most part, Hollywood is anti-gun, although they try not to portray that as well. They try to pretend like they actually get it fair and balanced. They really don't. And you need to understand your rights. You need to understand the law, and you need to understand how that, especially what you were believing and what you believed was the situation at the moment that occurred, because that is the main determining factor.
Yes.
I know that's given you a lot to think about, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it makes me feel better about protecting my home and my family. Yes, it does.
All right. Well, great. Thanks for calling the show.
Thank you.
Let's go out and talk to Ed in Dayton, who has a question for us. Ed, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
We are doing great. Thanks for joining us. How can we help you?
Just a quick question. I had a relative recently in the hospital. They heard their neighbor heard their home being broken into. They went out, fired warning shots in the air, then eventually shot in between the person's legs that scared them away. Now, they had to deal with the prosecutor, and I don't know the outcome. The detective inferred that it would probably be thrown out. So basically the question is, if you're out in an area, you scare someone away by pulling your firearm out if they're threatening you, is that something you're going to have a problem with, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it does. We're getting a little bit of noise on your line, so I'm going to pot you down for a second, and let me try to answer your question briefly, because we're going to need to leave and take a break here in a couple of minutes. But first, when you say fire a warning shot into the air, we really recommend against that. If you're going to fire a shot, it needs to be on target, and it needs to be because you are already at risk of grave bodily harm or death, and there was deadly force was justified to defend yourself or someone else. So firing a warning shot is really not a good idea. And using a gun to scare someone, you know, if that's what happens when you draw the gun out because it was already justified to apply deadly force, and you use a firearm to defend yourself, and in that short period of time between the threat and the ability to defend yourself, the brain of the criminal changes and says, oh, this was not the day I wanted to die after all, and stops, then you might not end up using that deadly force, but you need to be justified in in already applying it by the time you bring it out. So we really don't recommend using a gun as a threat or as intimidation to bring someone down, because that means you've introduced deadly force into the situation, and if it wasn't a deadly force encounter already, then it suddenly becomes one.
Now, the limited statistical data that's available to us says that in a civilian world, the majority of the times citizens draw their guns to protect themselves. They don't end up using it, but in fact, the criminal either runs away or he surrenders, and then he surrenders to law enforcement once they arrive on the scene. They don't necessarily have to shoot, and that's a different scenario. And the key point Mark made was those are civilians who took their gun out in defense of their life or someone else's life, and the criminal made the decision, I don't really want to get shot today, so I better lay down and surrender, or I better run away and live to commit another crime against a softer target at another time. So the reality is, it's threatening in the sense that as long as it's justified in the beginning, if the bad guy feels threatened, so be it. That's his situation. But in the scenario you gave, without knowing all the facts, I really don't want to comment on your friend's situation where the neighbors shot the up outcome. In the air. We don't know all the specific facts, and it would be erroneous for us to even attempt to guess about those facts. So we're not going to make any comment about that.
Thanks very much for calling the show. We need to take our last break of the hour. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro for Shooting from the Hip. Give us a call at 457-1290 if you'd like to be on the show. You're listening to AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO. Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro for Shooting from the Hip. Let's go right back out to the phones and talk to May. Welcome to Shooting from the Hip.
Hi.
How can we help you?
I have a question.
Okay, sure.
Why is it that handicapped people who don't have mental illness cannot have firearms?
Oh, they absolutely can. There's no reason why someone who's not, you know, doesn't have a mental problem, hasn't been adjudicated mentally defective, there's no reason why someone that is, like, for instance, has a mobility issue or other physical disability, there's no reason why they can't have firearms.
Oh, I was told they could not have them.
Oh, no, we have several people, in fact, that are members of SimTrainer that come and shoot from wheelchairs or for whatever other method. Yeah, in fact, the folks that have a physical disability are those at even a much greater risk, because some of the predators see that as a soft target and do some pretty despicable things, and being able to defend oneself from a wheelchair or from other physical disability is absolutely essential, in my opinion.
Oh, my goodness. I had an incident where someone broke in my home, and the two sheriffs did come out, and they tried to charge me. My gun was not registered, and I bought it at, like, a gun and knife show. I did not know.
Well, there's no need to. Is this in Ohio? Are you in Ohio?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, there is no need to register a gun in Ohio, so I'm not sure exactly what was going on there, but there was some misinformation or something didn't get understood correctly, because there is absolutely no prohibition on folks with a physical handicap from owning firearms, and there's no need to register a firearm in Ohio at all.
Do you need a permit?
No, not to have it inside your home. You need a license if you're going to carry concealed outside the home. But there's no need to have anything other than just the firearm, and keep it in good condition, because you want it to work when you need it.
Oh, that's good. Thank you.
Okay.
Oh, thank you so much.
I'm glad we could clear that up for you. Thanks for calling the show. And let's go out to Kurt, who's calling from Lebanon. Now, welcome to the show, Kurt.
Hi, how you doing?
We're doing great. How can we help you?
Okay, I have a question on bike trails.
Okay.
If I'm on the bike trail, can I have my concealed carry a handgun with me or not?
Do you, I assume you have a license to carry concealed handgun?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, then there's no reason you can't have your handgun with you while you're on a bike trail.
Okay, now what about open carry?
Well, we've talked about open carry a lot, and we don't really recommend open carry for a lot of reasons, but there's no law against it. You just need to be understanding that that puts you at a little bit greater risk of somebody trying to take it from you. It may also cause someone to get upset and cause, that might cause a disturbance. You may end up having an unintended interaction with law enforcement, because they'll get a call about someone having a gun. And a lot of times those calls aren't too terribly clear. So anytime the police have a man with a gun call, they respond. And so that would be you in that case. So, you know, that would just be a question that you'd need to deal with. And, you know, the fact that you have a license to carry concealed handgun, actually not required if you're carrying openly. But if you do have a license, it really doesn't give you any advantage to carry openly. We really recommend carrying in a holster and keeping it concealed.
Could I have a follow-up question?
Real quick, because we need to punch out here in just a minute.
Okay. You guys have any recommendation on how to carry on a bicycle?
I think two options. A fanny pack, that's going to be the most viable option for most people, and that because it'll keep the gun attached to you, and it's not going to – there's very little chance of it falling off of you because it's concealed. That's the – in my opinion, that's the best option for – the bicyclist.
And it depends a little bit on what kind of clothing you wear. So the other would be in a holster on your person at the belt, you know, with a good belt and put it in a typical, you know, like at a strong side concealed carry, maybe behind the hip. That certainly would work. I would recommend something that has a retention so that there's no possibility that it would fall out of the holster if you had a spill on the bike or just based on position. Thanks very much for calling the show. We need to close here in just a minute. Jeff?
Real quick, I just want to remind listeners that the Vietnam Veterans of America, the Miami Valley chapter, is holding a candlelight vigil 7 o'clock at the Vietnam Memorial right there at the entrance to the bikeway at the Stewart Street Bridge. And then 11 o'clock on Memorial Day, they're having their memorial service if you want to attend.
Thanks for being with us. See you Monday.